So I have to preface, aside from the fact that recovering from bronchitis, so I have to, I'll do the best that I can to not cough so much. But aside from that, I have to preface by saying that the shiur that I want to give tonight is really at least I'm going to give it in two parts. I'm going to give one now until Rabbi Milstein, and then I'm going to continue and give other parts of it during the time we usually do Sefer Yehoshua. But I want to preface it most importantly by saying that these are ideas that have not had time to really solidify in my mind. I have a certain framework that I'd like to present them in, but there's a lot more work to be done, and therefore I do not present them as ideas that are fully developed, and so therefore I present them more as food for thought. Now, as for where these thoughts have come from, aside from my own mind, which is obvious, they have come from a variety of sources. Amongst them, the Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Kirzner, Zatzal, as well as my cousins, more than one of them, but the Weinbergs, Rav Yaakov Weinberg and his sons. Yibad Elachaim, and as well my co-Rosh Yeshiva at the Yeshiva at IDT, Rabbi Dovi Weiss. So having tried at the beginning to attribute all the various ideas to their sources, I may not be able to attribute each particular idea as we go through them to the proper source, and therefore I'm going to hope that this preface will include all of those things. That would be great. Thank you very much.
Water
would be perfect. Thank you. So we've discussed many, many times. I always feel that it's important to at least re-mention it because it's so central to understanding any particular chag. That chagim, that holidays in Judaism are a cycle that is a little bit different, or at least seems to be different than the way it is in other cultures. Because rather than celebrating the anniversary of an event that happened in the past, we are in fact marking the anniversary of an event that happened in the past. Thank you very much. Sure. We are marking an event that happened in the past, and we are using the mitzvos and the customs, the observances and the customs that Chazal and the Torah, for that matter, gave us during that time period, to re-experience, to reconnect with those ideas and those growth opportunities, really, that happened in the past. We've described in the past as being kind of a light or an energy that Hashem puts into the world during that time. And on the deeper, I guess, some more mystical levels, we can look at it that way. We can also look at it in a very simple way, just being the experiences that one has as they go through life, just as one has experiences as they go through a life cycle, a regular life cycle, as they go through the year. One would hope that the building, for example, of a snowman when you are 6 years old is not going to be the same building of a snowman that occurs when you are 35 years old. Because if it's the same exact thing, then clearly there's some developing that needs to take place in a hurry. Yet it's the same action. And so too, by the chagim, by the holidays, we have chagim that happen year after year. And if our experience of these chagim are the same year after year, so that tells us that we are not growing the way that we should be. Because as we grow in life, we encounter new experiences, we encounter new things that test us and that mold us and that allow us to grow. And therefore, we should really experience every year the same chag in a completely new way. Obviously, some years will grow more than others, and some years will be harder to see that growth, but that's at least the goal. So, therefore, every Chanukah, we return to Chanukah. It's a simple, seems like a simple holiday, simple mitzvot that go along with it, lighting the menorah, and simple customs that go along with it. But yet, every year we find more and more depth, and hopefully those correspond with the growth that we do during the year. So, we have in Hanukkah, the idea is as follows. I'm going to start, let's leave that as it is. I'm going to start with a story that we've mentioned before, we've discussed it before, but I'd like to discuss it in perhaps a little bit of a different way tonight. It's a beautiful story. The story is that in 1990 was an election year, if I'm not mistaken. Does anyone figure that out? Well, if next year, being 2008, is an election year, you go back to 2000. No, it was 92 was then. 2000, it was 1980 was an election year. Is that correct? 1980.
Every 4 years, right?
Yeah. So if 2008 is, then 2000 was an election year, and 92 was an election year, 1980, I believe it was 1980. There was, so the election in 1980, if my memory serves me correctly, was between, I would assume, Ronald Reagan and probably Carter, if I'm not mistaken. That sounds like around 1980, and Jim Carter. So let's assume that's what it was, and those who have tape recordings and video recordings can do their homework and, you know, write all sorts of corrections and criticisms that I didn't do my homework for this year. But in fact, right, so let's say 1980 was the election in America, the presidential election between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. So the morning of the election, when the election results, election day is usually November, what is it, November 5th, right? So election day is November 5th. So the morning of November 6th in Eretz Yisrael, in Bnei Brak, there's a kollel of Bnei Brak where people have been learning in this kollel for years and years and years. And so there's an older member of the kollel who used to come every morning way before davening. And he would, like the Hasidim or Rishonim, he'd prepare for an hour before davening, and he was a tremendous, tremendous Bala Voda. So he gets there early in the morning, and he's waiting by the door, and every single person who comes into the room, he's saying, you know, who won the election? Who won the election? And so, being Eretz Yisrael and Bnei Brak, where most people weren't even paying really that much attention to the election, it was like, well, election, what election, what election? The American election, the president's election. Oh, I don't know. So finally, somebody came in, and told him, and somebody who had been, I guess, you know, seeing the news or listened to the news, definitely not seen the news, Chas v'Shalom, had listened to the news and heard that Ronald Reagan had won the election. So he came in and he said, Ronald Reagan won the election. So he said, ah, good. Thank you so much. And then he ran to his place and he opened his siddur and he started davening with tremendous, tremendous hislavos, with tremendous kavana. So, and he started his day. So the people who knew him were very, very surprised. I mean, this is not somebody who usually paid any attention to politics whatsoever. He was a person who sat and learned all day. He wasn't interested in what was going on outside. He wasn't interested in Israeli politics. He wasn't interested, not a person who read the newspapers. I mean, there are talking such people, amazing people. They dedicate their entire life to studying of Torah. And they're really completely, completely disengaged from the rest of the world. Their whole world is the Dalet Amos of Torah, the Dalet Amos of Halacha. And if a person is able to live in that way, it's an amazing, amazing thing, a wonderful thing. These are the people who hold up the world in a very literal way. And he was one of them. So people were very surprised. This elderly man who's devoted 30, 40 years to sitting and learning and disengaging from the rest of the world. And he needs to know who won the election in America. So after davening, they asked him about it, and they challenged him. They said, well, you know, what is it? It's, you're so interested. It's such an important thing for you to know. So he answered. He said, listen, when I get up in the morning, I get to shul, I have to make brachos. When I make brachos, so I make the bracha of Shaloy Asani Goy. He says, when I make the bracha of Shaloy Asani Goy, he says, so who should I have a kavana? Who should I be thinking about that Shaloy Asani Goy? Should I be thinking about some, you know, lo yutzlach, who's lying in the street somewhere in you know, in New York on the Bowery, like they used to, you know, drunk because he's gone nowhere in life, and I should say Shalei Asani Goy? What's the chiddush? Of course Shalei Asani Goy. He said, well, who should I be thinking about? Who should I have kavana? So I have to have kavana For a guy who's in a tremendously lofty position. I can't think of anybody who's in a more powerful, more lofty position than the President of the United States of America. This is the guy that is the most powerful, most important guy in the world. And it's on that guy that I have kavana, shelo yasani guy. I remember hearing this story in the late 1980s or the 1990s, and it made a very big impact on me. It was like very interesting chap that Taka, you make this bracha, you have to have some sort of bracha tzvichas kavana, you have to have some sort of kavana. So what's your kavana? So it makes a lot of sense, you have to have kavana. That not just that I'm happy that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made me a Yisrael, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't make me a guy, shelo asani guy, after all, that's the Lashon. And so who's the guy that I'm going to think about? Okay, the president. It's a very, 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 very interesting insight. And of course, there's the you know, you go out into the world and Baruch Hashem involved a lot in Kiruv and so on. This is not a story that would be easy to tell over in certain Kiruv situations, because there's something about it that sounds very radical. It sounds like after all, not every single president is a lowlife, right? Many of them probably were, you know, good people who really wanted to do good for the country. Many of them, they certainly have been very helpful to Klal Yisrael. They certainly have been set up, whether it was intentionally or not, but have set up a country where Klal Yisrael, for the first time in several thousand years, can practice Yiddishkeit in comfort without being attacked and so on and so forth. Some would argue too much comfort, but okay. But the bottom line is we're not persecuted here, so. It seems a little bit, there's something that seems a little bit it's a little difficult to understand, or a little bit abrasive about looking at it in that way. It's one of those ideas. So, you know, usually what I think to myself is, okay, yeah, it sounds a little bit abrasive, but that's because we live in this Western culture where everything goes and everything's accepted, and it's hard to remember that there's actually huge differences on the neshama level between a member of B'nai Yisrael and a non-member of B'nai Yisrael, and that there's tremendous, sometimes we don't see those differences so much on the outside, unfortunately, but that's because we're in Gullus. But really, if you think down to the core of the matter, there's a huge difference, and we have to recognize that, and we have to, so I always try to kind of overcome that feeling, that slight feeling of discomfort, by reminding myself of the side of the story that is beautiful, that the idea that we want to think of ourselves as being the Am HaNivchar, the chosen nation, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose us to be his emissaries, his ambassadors out into the world to bring the idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the one true God, of the Torah, and so on, to the world, which will ultimately lead to V'haya Bayom Ahu Yeh Hashem Echad Shmo Echad, that all the people will of the world will recognize Hashem as the one true God, and therefore bring the age of the Geula for all the world. It has occurred to me through an understanding and through an examination of a number of sources of what is really going on in Hanukkah that perhaps there's another way to understand this story and reinterpret it in a way that not only is not at all abrasive, but is actually very, I believe, in a way, even more profoundly beautiful than the way the story is initially understood. It's on a deeper level. It's a little bit harder to understand, and we have to understand a number of things, and it comes through an understanding of some of the things that are going on in Hanukkah that we can get to this deeper understanding of this story. And therefore, perhaps a deeper understanding of the bracha itself. Because after all, the story is, in a sense, a perush on the bracha. Hanukkah, to a great extent, has been oversimplified. And the reason it's been oversimplified is because It seems on the surface that it's quite simple. There's a war. There's a war between the Jews and the Greeks. The Jews win. There's a miracle, right? The Greeks had sacked the Beis HaMikdash, and there's a miracle. They're looking around for oil, and they find this one bottle of oil, and it burns for 8 days and nights, right? These seem like very simple concepts, and that's what we kind of, when we grow up, we focus on these concepts. And if you look historically, if you take history and you start reading what really went on and about the Milchamos and all the things that were going on, you'll very quickly realize that the idea that Hanukkah is a celebration of the Nes that happened in the Milchama is a very, very I'm not going to deny it because Chazal said that's one of the main reasons why they instituted it. But it's hard to understand. You have to ask, why did Chazal choose this? Because after all, it wasn't the only battle, and it wasn't a defining battle. There were other battles that came afterwards, and the idea that this battle somehow gave Klal Yisrael a sense of identity, a sense of freedom from the oppressor, is one that if you look historically speaking, it's true, but it didn't last very long at all. It lasted a couple of years, perhaps at most. You could probably count on your fingers how probably less than 10 years that it lasted. So make a whole holiday out of a battle that's a part of a series of battles that never really seemed to accomplish what we think it should accomplish. I mean, after all, what should a battle over freedom accomplish? It should accomplish freedom, right? It should accomplish absolute freedom. But this never does accomplish absolute freedom. It accomplishes a mediocre kind of a freedom. A freedom that lasts. It doesn't quite last. There's political issues that go on and on and on. The political issues don't end. They go on and on from there. The political issues go on and on and on all the way through the destruction of the second base on Mikdash. There's really no good resolution. So you would think a chag that celebrates victory should celebrate a real victory, right? Not a half-baked victory. And then but what can you do? Chazal tells us it's because of the victory. So we have to understand what this means. What is it about this particular victory, even though in terms of political independence and in terms of even political independence in terms of, you know, power, the power seat going to Klal Yisrael, it was a very short-lived victory. So why do Chazal still hold on to it and proclaim it to be such a victory? And also, when you talk about the Nes, so there are many Nisim that happened in the history of Klal Yisrael, many amazing Nisim that happened, and most of them you don't find that we grab onto them, that Chazal grabbed onto them, and that they made a chag about it. And so again, okay, it's a Nes, it's a beautiful Nes. There were Nisim that happened in the Beis HaMikdash all the time. Right, so there are many answers to these questions. I'm not suggesting that there aren't answers. Many, many answers. I'm just building these questions to suggest a certain pattern that's going on, and the pattern that we see really leads to something that's a little bit deeper. Although in the second shir we'll see that that's oversimplified as well. But let's take it at least a little deeper, and we'll say it's not about the physical battle. It's not about the seat of power. It's not just about the miracle of the Nair, but it's about really a cultural war. A cultural war. And the cultural war is obviously the cultural war that exists between the Greeks and Bnei Yisrael. Right? This is really the war that Chazal were talking about. Many Sfarim talk about this. There's a lot of Torah written on it. And it's true. This is true. There was a cultural war because, after all, the Greeks were the originators of philosophy in the secular sense, right? Philosophy. And philosophy, their philosophy carried with it a certain numbers of ideas that seemed very, very much diametrically opposed to the ideas of Klal Yisrael. For example, the simplest example is the idea that the Greek philosophy glorifies the human body. And Greek philosophy declares that that all of life revolves around the human body, but not the human body in terms of its lower, more base application in terms of held up as a philosophic object of beauty. I mean, after all, you could even in modern terms you could understand if one were to argue, they have a lot of problem with this, but in the secular world. But if one were to take an evolutionary position. Right? We're not here to discuss evolution and how that applies to Torah and so on, but let's just step out of the Torah world for a minute, and so let's say one were to embrace an evolutionary position and to say that evolution is the way that the world progresses. One could make an argument, although it makes people uncomfortable, but one could make an argument that the evolutionary process has produced many amazing, wonderful, fascinating creatures, but it has only produced... Again, when I say this again, I'm not saying that I believe this, chas v'shalom. It requires a lot of discussion. But let's say one would embrace this position. The only creature that evolution has ever produced that is able to think of evolution and to consider evolution is the human being. So one could make the argument that the human being is, in fact, the apex, the most amazing creation of evolution. So even from a very secular position, without believing in God at all, one could arrive at the conclusion that the human being is the most beautiful, most amazing, highest form of creation. And in fact, Greek philosophy was not all that different. I mean, they didn't have the evolutionary theory, but it's not all that different. They felt that human beings being the center of the world, they understood that, they understood perhaps better than the evolutionists that that the creatures and all that exists in the world is focused all on humanity, and human being exists at, center point around which all other existence revolves. And so therefore they consider the human being from a philosophic standpoint, from a deep philosophic standpoint, to be the most beautiful, most perfect thing that, in existence. And so therefore that's why when the Greeks were attacking, so to speak, the Torah, one of the main areas that they attacked was the area of Bris Milah, the area of circumcision, because after all, to a Greek who holds up the human being as a specimen of perfection, so to go ahead and to somehow maim and to somehow claim that you're adding perfection to something that's already perfect by maiming, by cutting something off, is a tremendous travesty of justice. I mean, what, it doesn't make any other sense. Why else would Greeks have such a big problem with Bris Milah? And you see that that was a very big deal. It was a very big issue over there, because the Misyavnim, those who were trying to be Greeks, they tried to hide the Bris Milah, all sorts of Torah on that. So where's that coming from? It's coming from a perspective, a philosophic perspective, a highly developed philosophic perspective, because to this day, Greek philosophy occupies a tremendously important place in the philosophy of the world, that that considered the human being to be the center point of the world and the object of perfection that exists in the world. So along comes Klal Yisrael and says, no, absolutely not. The world does not revolve around the human being, but rather the world revolves around HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the human being who places HaKadosh Baruch Hu, places the creator of the world, and who embraces the creator of the world, recognizing the one true God, who embraces that one true God and brings that one true God into his or her life, that human being will have the world revolving around them, but not because they as a human being are perfect, but rather because they have brought the creator of the world into their lives in such a meaningful, deep way as to cause them to be the center of existence. And that's why, by the way, I mean, this fits in very much so with the way that we see that the Torah treats the creation of the human being, because after all, we see that if we read, there are two accounts of the creation of a human being that occur in Bereshis. And if you read the first of them, it seems like the human being, the Adam, is created last. And if you read the second one, it kind of sounds like the Adam is created first. And there are different midrashim that talk about this and discuss this. And one of the things that comes out of these midrashim is that, of course, it's a discussion of the Gemara, actually, that it's up to a human being. If a human being brings HaKadosh Baruch Hu into his life or her life, and makes their life significant in a spiritual sense by connecting themselves to the creator of the universe, so then they are created first, and every single other being that was created is subjugated to them. And they're number one. But if, in fact, a person just lives as a person that's disconnected from the creator, that's just another animal, so to speak. So if you're just another animal, you should know you were created the end of the chain. Even a mosquito was created, the Medrash says, even a mosquito was created before you. Right? You're the least important. So Klal Yisrael has a very different perspective. Klal Yisrael says that that the world only revolves around human beings if human beings embrace HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But without HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the world doesn't revolve around us. The world revolves around HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if we remove ourselves from that, so the world continues to revolve around HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we get caught up in the whirlwind, so to speak. Very, very different point of view. So there's a tremendous clash of cultures, because the Greek culture is saying, you know, it's all about us human beings. And the culture of Klal Yisrael is saying, no, it's all about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's a very, very big clash. So if we look at it that way, we start looking at it that way, we can start to understand that there's a war going on, it's true, and there are battles going on, it's true, but not just physical battles, there are spiritual battles going on. And those spiritual battles are battles between very profoundly different ways of looking at the world, and therefore a victory of the type that the Chashmonaim had was considered to be not just a victory, a physical victory, but it was a victory of Klal Yisrael. As the Gemara says at one point, the Medrash says, I think it's brought down in the Gemara, the Medrash says that if the Kohanim had not lit the menorah when they rescued the Beis HaMikdash and they liberated the Beis HaMikdash, if they had not lit the menorah, so there would have been no hope left for the mission of the Jewish people in the world. Because after all, if they had recaptured the Beis HaMikdash and not immediately sought to sanctify it and to bring Kedusha in, to bring light, so to speak, and to bring the light of connection between HaKadosh Baruch Hu between the spiritual realms and the physical realms, so then the battle would have ultimately been lost, even though the physical battle would have been won, but the spiritual battle would have been lost. After all, a ner, as we mentioned last week, a ner is a combination of several things. There's the ner itself, which is the either the receptacle or even just the light itself. But the ner also requires a psila, a wick, and shemen, an oil, in order for it to be a ner. And ner, shemen, and psila, ner, psila, and shemen, says the Gra, is nefesh. The first letter of each one is, it spells nefesh. The human being represents, and the Chazal, the deepest form, discuss all the time that a ner represents a neshama, that the ner is like a neshama, that the ner is, it represents, as a matter of fact, if you look at the, we've spoken about this before in the past also, we've totally discussed this, that if you look at the light of a candle, you'll see that the ner actually has three, there are three different parts to the light. There's the outer part, which is more like orange, there's like an inside part, which is brown, and there's a little tiny part in the middle, which is like blue. And those three parts represent different parts of the neshama, and all different ways of looking at it. There are those ways of looking at it that the wick, that the three parts of the ner also represent different parts of the three parts of the neshama. There's the upper part of the neshama is the flame. You can't really capture it. You can't really hold it in anything. And then there's the wick, which is the conduit between that higher neshama and then the shemen, which represents the physical bodies that we are. So however you look at it, many different ways to slice the pie, so to speak. The Chazal and the deeper Sfarim are always talking about a human being like a ner. So if in fact, when the Chashmonaim recaptured the Beis HaMikdash, if they hadn't made an effort to relight the menorah, relighting the menorah is symbolic of saying, not only are we physically winning this battle and recapturing this territory, but in fact we are recapturing spiritual territory. We are reconnecting, we are establishing or re-emphasizing the fact that we believe that our connection must be between us down here and HaKadosh Baruch Hu above, and that's really why the battle was won, so to speak. However, all of this is very, very, very beautiful, but there's a lot of additional detail and information that we have to consider. For example, there's the idea that Chazal go very much out of their way to find a makar, a root, so to speak, for Hanukkah in the Torah. Now, it's kind of a strange thing. They shouldn't have to find a root for Hanukkah in the Torah. The Chachamim are allowed to establish anything they want, right? It's in the first Mishnah of Pirkei Avos. Right, a susayag la Torah. You can make a siyag for Torah. If the Chachamim decide, of any generation, decide that they want to establish a new mitzvah, they're allowed to establish a new mitzvah. Right? Obviously, in later generations, the Chachamim have been more and more hesitant to do something so radical. Yet, when it comes to the establishment of chagim, of holidays, they are far more reluctant to do so. Why that is, I don't think we're going to have time to go into that. I would suggest, partly because, as we mentioned at the beginning of this year, since the Chagim are tied into the life cycle and the development of a Jew as they go through the year, so to take something and make out of it a Chag is not just to say that I'm going to add a mitzvah or I'm going to add a mitzvah derabbanan because we, the Rabbanan, think that it's important, but it is more to say, it's to say that I have found something in the Jewish life cycle that wasn't there before, that really should have been there before. It's like adding to the core expression, to the core growth pattern of a Jew. to add to the core growth pattern of a Jew, to say this day that was not mentioned in the Torah is so important that it must be celebrated as part of the yearly cycle of Chagim, which contribute to the growth of a Jewish person by tapping into spiritual resources that are released into the world by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then how could I not find such a thing in the Torah? It's not just the Chachamim making a siyag to the Torah, right? They're saying, is that the air conditioning? Oh, it's heat. Okay, doesn't feel like heat, but you know. In any case, the idea. So again, to make a siyag la Torah, to make a fence for the Torah, so the Chachamim could do that in any generation. But instituting a new chag is not the same as instituting a new mitzvah. It's saying that there's something that happens at this time every year on a yearly basis that is integral to the development of a Jewish person. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because of what happened in history, releases into the world, into our world at this time, some sort of emanation that carries with it a certain energy that if we tap into these ideas by doing the mitzvos that the Torah tells us, the Chazal tell us, we're going to be able to grow in the same way that those people who experienced those things in history have grown. That's already a very huge statement, which is why Chazal struggle tremendously with the idea of creating a new chag. It is perhaps, although this is not a discussion for now at all, but it is parenthetically perhaps a reason why there is so much disagreement over the institution of new chagim over the last number of years, Yom HaAtzmaut and so on. These are very complicated ideas. The idea to introduce a new chag into Klal Yisrael is a very complicated thing. The Gemara struggles, Chazal struggle with it. They struggle with two chagim because there are two such chagim. The two main ones are obviously Chanukah and Purim. So they struggle to find a mekor, a root, a place to see that these chagim are tied in to the Torah, are tied in to the events or to the ideas in the Torah that were already there, so that Chazal are not creating something new. They're not claiming that there was something, so to speak, missing in the Torah by now saying, oh, now we have this new chag. Because again, remember, saying that there's something in the chag is not just a celebration of something that happened in the past. It's telling us that the thing that happened in the past is teaching us what we're supposed to be growing in, how we're supposed to be dealing with the present. For example, Chazal struggled tremendously with Purim. Particularly with Purim, they struggle very, very much until they find a certain psukim in the Torah that they feel that they can. So there's a beautiful mimer in Pach Yitzchak, we don't have time to go into that discusses this. So they find a certain pasuk in the Torah that tells them that they can, the idea of Purim is already in the Torah. But on a simpler level, I want to tell you one other thing, just also. That Chanukah and Purim have a very interesting distinction. They are the only two holidays that Chazal tell us are going to still be around forever, even when Mashiach comes. That they're going to outlast all the other holidays. It's possible will not be exactly the way they are. There's something, things will change about them. They may not be there. But Chanukah and Purim will never change. So it makes it even more complicated. If Chanukah and Purim, which are only the Rabbanan, will never change, the Rabbanan must have had a very, very significant reason to institute them, and they must have had some very, very strong understanding from the Torah itself, prior to the events that took place, that these are the emanations, these are the energies that exist in the world at this time, and where did they see this? So it's very interesting, they see this in the Torah, from the Haman min HaTorah Minayin, the very famous Gemara, where do you see Haman in the Torah? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, after the sin of eating from the Eitz Hadas Tovara, after they sinned from eating from the tree, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes down into the Gan, and he asks Adam and Chava, Hamin HaEitz HaZed, right, did you eat from this tree? So Hamin HaEitz HaZed, so Chazal say Hamin is the same letters as Haman. Haman HaEitz HaZed, the tree, Haman hung on a tree, and so on and so forth. They see a connection over there. Where do they see Chanukah? So a few psukim, two psukim before, HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes down to the Gan Eden, and he's looking for Adam and Chava, as if, so to speak, he can't find them, right? Which is ludicrous. He's looking for them, and he says, Ayeka, where are you? Ayeka. So Ayeka, say Chazal, Ayeka is, the gematria of Ayeka is 36. And the number of candles that we light in Hanukkah is 36. If you add up 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 7 plus 8, you have 36. So Ayeka, the answer, so to speak, to Ayeka, where are you? Ayeka means where are you? Hashem is asking, where are you? The answer is, in a sense, the 36 candles of Hanukkah. Amazing. What that? How they see that and why that's so important. Very, 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 very complicated what that's telling us. But we need to finish. So I don't know if I can give you a complete clarity in that. But I just I will say as follows that we also find one other place in the Torah that Aaron HaKohen, when it says Ba'aloscha Saneiros, that Aaron is given the job of putting up the Neiros. So Rashi there, the Mefarshim tell us that Aaron was very upset because the other Nesiim, the other princes of the other Shvatim, had all brought their offerings to the Mishkan, and they had all been accepted. There was nothing left to bring. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu kind of tells Aaron, don't worry, because you're going to be able to do the Neiros. And the Mefarshim explain that this is a reference not just to the Neiros in the Beis HaMikdash, which apparently wouldn't have been such a big deal on their own, but rather it's talking about the Neiros of Hanukkah. Amazing thing. So the Mefarshim are learning that when Hashem comforts Aaron and says, don't worry, you didn't get to bring to the Mishkan, but don't worry, later on, you're going to be Zocha to institute Ner Chanukah, because after all, it's the Kohanim who relit the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash when that Pach Shemen was found, when that small jug of oil was found. It's like an amazing thing. Aaron is upset. We're now completely dedicating this new Mishkan, this whole new idea. The Mishkan we think of in the Midbar as being like a tremendously high, close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu enterprise. So don't worry, it's not so bad that you didn't get to contribute to this Mishkan. Much later on, your people, the Kohanim, are going to end up contributing to this kind of like half-baked Beis HaMikdash, which is liberated, but not really. The Shekhinah isn't there, and I don't even know if it was the original menorah that was there, and it's not even going to stay there for too long, but the people will eventually light it in their homes. Like, you know, that's his comfort. Yeah, but all these people are contributing to the building of the first Mishkan. That sounds like something that certainly sounds like much, much more glorious and much, much more appealing. So it's an interesting thing that Chazal are learning something about the menorah, something about Ner Chanukah that is more important, more significant than the building of the Mishkan in the Midbar, right? Because that's how Aaron is. So what is going on here? So we can say like this, without getting into the details, which we're going to go into in the second shir, but we want to finish in a timely fashion. So we will say as follows, that there is a tremendous, we'll just say this chiddush, and this chiddush is mind-blowing, but it's not my own, Chazal say it, and that's how I have the guts to say it. And I will say also that these are ideas that are not fully developed and certainly subject to being questioned and so on. Chazal tell us, it says in the Zohar, that the nation that is closest to Klal Yisrael, that is the closest match to Klal Yisrael, is Yavon, of the Greeks. And that actually, as I heard from my cousin Eretz Yisrael, actually finds expression in a halachic fact. The fact is that if you write a Sefer Torah, you are not allowed to write a Sefer Torah, nor are you allowed to read from a Sefer Torah that is written in any other language except for Lashon HaKodesh, with one exception, and that is a Sefer Torah that is written in Greek. Now, that's an amazing thing. And how does the Gemara learn that you're allowed to learn this, that you're allowed to write a Sefer Torah in Greek, that you're allowed to have a Sefer Torah that's written in Greek? Because there is a pasuk in the Torah in the beginning in Bereshis that says, Yaft Elokim b'yefes v'yishkon b'ahalei shem. This is when, after Shem, Chem, and Yafes, right, the children of Noach, there's brachos and klolos that are given because of the way that they acted after they came out of the Teva. And so there's this pasuk that says, Yaft Elokim b'yefes v'yishkon b'ahalei shem. What does this mean? Yaft Elokim b'yefes, the beauty of Hashem, Yaft Elokim, the beauty of Hashem, B'yefes was given to Yefes. Who is Yefes? Yefes is the progenitor, the forefather of Yavan. So the beauty of Elohim was given to Yavan, v'yishkon ba'ahalei shem. But it is going, that beauty will dwell right? In the tents of Shem. Who is Shem? The progenitor and the forefather of Yisrael, right? Avram comes from Shem. So you have this pasuk. So the Gemara learns as follows. What is the most beautiful thing of Yefes, of Yavan? What is the most beautiful thing of Yavan? So you could make various arguments. You could say the sculpture, you could say the philosophy, you could say, but Chazal say something very, very interesting. It's very profound. The language of a people is its most beautiful thing. If you want to really, truly understand a culture, you need to understand and examine its language, the way it describes things. If you want to read, for example, I'm only saying this based on reputation, I've never done it myself, but if you want to read any of the great Russian novels that we read sometimes in translated, you know, versions in English, if you really want to appreciate them, so anybody who knows Russian will say that there's nothing, the Havdil, of course, but there's nothing that compares to reading, you know, Tolstoy in the original Russian. There are certain nuances and expressions and ideas that are expressed in Russian that really can't be translated because the whole culture of what he was writing from is all expressed in the language. It's the language that is the pe'er, the beauty, so to speak, of a people. So the Yaft Elokim B'Yefes, the beauty that Hashem put into Yefes, put into Yavan, where will we find its most accessible expression in the language? V'yishkon be'ahalei Shem. That language, therefore, has to have a resting place in the tents of Shem, says the Gemara. What are the tents of Shem? The tents of Shem are the Beis Medrash. So where is it going to find? In the tents of Shem, an expression in Greek, a Sefer Torah, written in Greek, is not puzzle, you're allowed to read from it. Amazing, amazing halacha. So what's going on over here? What are we being taught by this? So clearly what we're being taught is, as based on the Zohar, that Yavan, the Greek culture, is not that it's diametrically opposed to Klal Yisrael. This way that we were looking at it before, that there's this tremendous clash of cultures, and that's what the Nes of Chanukah is. We have to re-examine that. And we have to say perhaps that we have to look at it a different way. That the culture of Yavan is most similar to Klal Yisrael, and perhaps, by the way, that's why it may be the most dangerous. Right? We have to understand that something that's completely dissimilar, that's completely out of the possibility of considering. So, I'm a member of Klal Yisrael. I'm not going to be a part of that. It's only something that's really similar that might be exert a draw and try to draw me in. It's much more dangerous if it's similar. So, therefore, when we now look at the Nes of Chanukah, so we see a whole different thing. There was a tremendous battle going on. It's a clash of cultures. It's true. But the clash of cultures was a very subtle clash of cultures. It was a clash of cultures that were very similar in many, many ways. But there was a subtlety. And I want to tell you something very, very beautiful. You may have heard this before. That the word Yavan is very similar to Judaism. Because the word Yavan is the same word as Tzion, except with a tzaddik in front of it. It's the exact same letter. Yavan, yud, vav, nun. If you put a tzaddik in front of it, it's tzion. So the tzion, meaning Klal Yisrael, right? Tzion, Zion. It's Klal Yisrael, tzion, is Yavan with a tzaddik beforehand. So that is to tell us, that is to teach us, that Yavan and tzion are extremely similar. They're almost the same. There's subtleties, and the differences are very, very subtle. And the Nes of Chanukah, so to speak, represents the light that is shed on those differences. And the victory that was celebrated was a victory of the subtleties. That's why you look at the Nes. Okay, there's this Nes, there's many Nisim, there's this victory, there are many victories. It's not even the final victory. I'm not talking about any of that. We're talking about an internal thing. There was an internal thing that happened. We have to perhaps explore that and develop it more. What exactly is that internal thing that happened? But there's an internal thing that happened where there was a victory of the subtle differences between Klal Yisrael and the amazing similarities of the Greeks. Very different way of looking at it. So now that we look at it that way, we can go back to the story that we said in the beginning and reinterpret the whole story. The story we said in the beginning, for those of you who weren't here, I'm just going to repeat it. And then I'll take questions afterwards. I just have to finish by 9:15. So the story we said in the beginning was how this old Jew in Bnei Brak was walking around the 1980 elections before davening, trying to find out who won the American elections for U.S. president. And finally, they told him who won, and he said, and he ran to his seat, he started davening. So they asked him after davening, what do you don't follow Israeli politics, you don't follow any politics, you don't take your head out of the sefer all day, what do you care who won the election in America? So he said, when I start davening in the morning, I'm going to say the bracha of Shalom Asani Gai. And when I say the bracha of Shalom Asani Gai, I want to think of the most powerful, amazing guy in the world, and still make the bracha Shalom Asani Gai. So he said, the initial understanding of that bracha and the beauty of that bracha seems to be like, wow, that's a very profound idea. If I'm going to say the bracha of Shalom Asani Gai, I want to think of the most amazing guy in the world, and say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm thanking you that I'm worlds apart from him, that I'm so completely different, that I have nothing to do with such a person. Shalom Asani Gai. But now that we understand, and by the way, let's not fool ourselves, even though we call this Galus Edom it is, but it's Galus Edom that from a philosophical standpoint is still Galus Yavan, right? The Greek philosophy and Western civilization is not built on the sword of Rome. It's built on the culture of Greece, on the aesthetic of Greece. So now we can look at the story, and we mentioned before that there's a little, it's a beautiful story, but it kind of, there's something about it that's a little abrasive. But now I could look at it as a very different story, and perhaps, I don't know if this was his kavanah or not, but we can at least understand it on a deeper level. We can say that it's true that a person, when they make the bracha of Shalom Asani Gai, so perhaps they should be thinking that, certainly not thinking of some, you know, non-Jew who's not doing well in life, who's, you know, is lying drunk somewhere in the street. that's ridiculous. So I don't need to make a bracha Shalom Asani Gai for that. That's obvious. But I should think of a non-Jew who's extremely powerful and is extremely developed and is extremely brilliant and is extremely, looked up to by the rest of the world. And I guess at one time the president of America was such a person, but we can still make an argument that there's still at least the position carries with it in something like that. But now we can look at it and say it a little bit differently, with a more of a subtlety. I'm not looking for that person to say that I'm worlds apart from him, that I'm worlds apart. In other words, but what I'm looking at that person to say, we're the same. I'm the same. We're exactly the same. That person is the person in the world that I'm most similar to. I am, as a member of Klal Yisrael, I am most similar to Yavan. I am most similar to the great thinkers of the world, to the philosophers, to the doctors, to the presidents, to those who are accomplishing things in the West, in Western society. Those are the people that I am most similar with, and still I make the bracha Shalom Asani Gai to remind myself that although we might seem like we're the same, we're still different. There might be a subtlety, and I might have to look very hard to find it. It's not always so obvious, right? Sometimes it's very obvious, but sometimes it's not so obvious, right? I might have to look at it, and that's the avoda, perhaps. That's the avoda of Chanukah, because after all, if you look around at the world, I want to tell you something. You look around, we have a country, right? It's actually a very similar situation to the way it was back then. They had a country, but it wasn't 100% theirs. There were political realities that they had to deal with. We have the same. We have a country, a Eretz Yisrael. There are political realities to deal with. It's not so simple. We have to think every single second, anytime anyone in Eretz Yisrael does something, you have to think what the rest of the world is saying. If you look around at the rest of the world, let's talk about America, that represents the height of Western civilization. There are a lot. You could look at Eretz Yisrael. You could say, "Listen, you know what? I look at America. It's easier to live there. The economic system seems to work better. People are not going on strikes every day, right? There's people are polite, right? There's an idea. For the most part, there's an idea that the customer is always right, and there's a lot of things that make it a lot simpler to live in America. You go to Israel, you walk into a store, you'd think, you know, if you ask the wrong question, you'd think like, you know, you were trying to shoplift, because you asked, you know, they'll bite your head off, right? So if you look on the outside, sometimes it's not always so easy to see. Obviously, I'm not talking about people who are sitting and learning and so on, but if you look just at Klal Yisrael, we're not all sitting and learning, unfortunately. That's the reality. The reality is that Klal Yisrael in America, in a certain sense, are, you know, when I go in Eretz Yisrael and I wear my beard and payas, and I try to talk to a non-firm Jew in Eretz Yisrael, so there's immediately a huge barrier that goes up. He assumes that I'm trying to convert him, and maybe it's not part of his on my side also, that I assume that he assumes that. I don't know what it is, but for some reason we can't talk. It's not just because I'm not fluent in Ivrit, right? There's immediately a barrier. When I meet somebody here in America, a non-religious Jew, a Reform Jew, or a conservative Jew, there's no barrier. They're interested, they're curious, they're polite, right? So you could, it's not always so simple to see the difference, but Shalom Asani Gai is telling us that we have to understand Enochinami. We're similar, and our value, in a sense, of the way we look at the world, look at Western culture, Western civilization has a tremendous impact on even the most frum yeshivas that there are. Any time that there's a Chinese auction that goes on, right, with these catalogs that come out with all the amazing stuff that you can find there, that is a direct product of Western civilization. The values in that are not Torah values. Or are they? It depends. So if you put the tzaddik in front of it, it's for tzedakah, right? So then it's tzion. So then taka, you could say, okay, so it's a Torah value. But the second you take that tzaddik away, it's yavan. It's yavan. It's not a Torah value. It's subtle. It's subtle. So shalo asani goy is about a subtlety. It's about looking for the best of the creme de la creme of yavan, so that I can understand that I have to find my difference. I have to find my subtlety. I think that's the job, and that's the message for us here in this time. I'll add one parenthetical note that has nothing to do with Hanukkah whatsoever, but as I was driving here, I was thinking about this. I called my wife up to ask her if she thought that this had any truth, and she felt that it merited saying over. Both my wife and I teach tefillah, and any time we get, particularly when we're teaching women, the bracha of Shalo Asani Isha, so it's a difficult bracha to explain. On a simple level, without going into it, when a man says, "I'm thanking Hashem that I wasn't made into a woman," I wasn't made a woman. So the way the language sounds, it sounds a little bit abrasive. It sounds difficult. The simplest explanation is that the language of Chazal, when they instituted the bracha, is not the language of ourselves today. We don't have the ears and the subtleties to understand exactly what it meant. But yet there it is, right next to the bracha of Shalo Asani Eved and Shalo Asani Goy and Shalo Asani Isha. It's a little different. So I was thinking that we could use the same idea and explain the bracha of Shalo Asani Isha in the same way, and it changes the whole way of looking at the bracha. Because after all, when it comes to Avodas Hashem, there's really not so much difference between men and women, right? I mean, we know all the difference halachically that there are, but Lemaisa, what are we? We're all human beings, and the idea is for us to be here and connect our physicality with our spirituality, connect our physical existence in this world with our Kaddish Baruch Hu, the spiritual existence in the world beyond. We have Avodas Hashem, so there are different paths to it, but in fact, there are also many, many similarities, right? So when we say Shalo Asani Isha, if you understand it from this same perspective, perhaps you can say that it's Shalo Asani Isha because I have to understand that our mission and our goal is really so similar that one could get lost in the idea that really that we're exactly the same, that there's no difference. And in a chinami, sometimes it's very hard to see the difference. Sometimes you'll find women who are far, far more advanced in many, many areas of Avodas Hashem than men. Right, you have it. Look at what's going on in the shidduch world today. Right, you have unbelievably qualified young women who can't find young men who are learning in yeshivas who are on the same level of sophistication in Yiddishkeit, on the same level of inspiration and so on. I mean, I'm not making this up. This is an issue that we're facing. So the pshat is that sometimes there's a certain subtlety that a man has to wake up to Shalo Asani Isha, perhaps, to recognize that with all the similarities, I have to find those things and embrace them because those things will help to define me, and that's my avoda in the world. So that the words Shalo Asani are no longer coming in the sense to say that I'm completely different, worlds apart. Thank God I'm not like that other person, or I'm not like that, but rather to say, no, I'm so similar that if I'm not careful to find the differences, then our similarities will cause us to merge in a sense, and we'll lose sight of the growth potential that we have as Klal Yisrael in terms of the bracha Shalo Asani Goy, and as a man in the terms of the bracha Shalo Asani Isha. So that's the close parentheses on that idea, and I wish you all a Freilich and Chanukah.